Welcome to episode 332 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, EW Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we have a delightful conversation with actor, writer, and film director Edward William Wasser. Right now, he's eagerly anticipating the outcome of the IMDb Film Awards because a movie he wrote and directed, titled Gun, has been nominated for Best Picture. Yes, he'll be going to Hollywood in a week or so from when we recorded our conversation. We have a wonderful conversation about his film, about filmmaking, about various experiences and influences he's had over the years, and the challenges that come with making independent films and being an artist, and a little bit about society in the U.S. generally, and regarding more specifically politics and news and mindsets and the like. A great conversation with Edward William Wasser today in the program. We also have an EW essay titled Guns, and another original piece written and read by our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, titled Tyler Sex Goddesses, and a poem called Bird. All of this, of course, as is always the case, is imbued, infused with the energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 332 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
Yeah.
guns. The sun on this paper shines so beautifully bright as I write. I feel stoned immaculate. Thank you, Mr. Mojo Rising, for sharing such a wonderful sentiment all those years ago, yet still timeless. Art, heart, human soul is never retro. These are where we come from, where we instinctively seek to be. The place when given the option, the place we invariably go. As I sit in this car writing with the window open on a hilltop urban neighborhood in front of the old Harriet Beecher Stowe Primary Schoolhouse, I watch and listen as two gentlemen a little further up this hilltop talk with one another. One standing on the public sidewalk, holding the chain link leash attached to his dog. The dog is tugging and smelling the dew-covered grass. The other gentleman, sitting atop a glider, setting on the floor of his front porch. We talk to ourselves and each other about love. Most of us would claim to be loving people, like those two gentlemen, I suppose. Maybe we love in the form of tough love. For some, that's the way it goes. For others, in the form of many hugs and kisses. Yet, we all too often, each of us and in the collective, turn our backs when aggression, confusion, fear approaches our real, our sanctum, our self-indulgence. I wonder what they taught the young ones in this old schoolhouse, how they allowed them to be. I wonder what we allow ourselves to learn, feel, and see.
Telling all the stars a name, hoping it is tell her, hey, and I love you, baby. I love you, baby. Running all through my brain, wishing that I could stay, yeah, just hold you, baby. Just to hold you, baby. Control and by my control.
Edward William Wasser, is that you?
It is me. Can you hear me, Lawrence?
I could hear you, yes. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah is right.
Edward William Wasser is an actor, writer, and film director based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And Edward got involved with film making as a way to get attention for his acting, and has since written and appeared in the films Contrition, The Passionate Ones, and Gun, which has, by the way, won numerous Best Picture and Best Actor awards all over the United States. We'll get into that more in a bit. Edward has studied acting and theater at Barry University in Miami, Florida, also with Milton Katselas, George DiCenzo, and Playhouse West Philadelphia. He studied writing with Academy Award-winning writer of Birdman, Alex Dean Laris. Mr. Wasser currently has a movie entitled Small Packages in post-production. His short film titled Gun, which he wrote and directed, is nominated for the IMDb's Best Picture Award. Edward is leaving for L.A. on August 27th to attend the gala. And we today are very happy here at Troubadours and Rock on Tours to have Edward William Wasser on the program. Again, thanks. Thanks for taking the time out. I know you're busy.
No problem. And just so you know, Edward William Wasser is something I had to do for Screen Actors Guild, but everybody calls me Ed, so you can just call me Ed.
Okay, I'll call you Ed. That sounds cool. I was always a little skeptical about my pronunciation of certain names that are, you know, like my name, my last name is Italian, but people say it the wrong way, and, you know, you don't know which way is the acceptable way. So I hope any of those folks that you hold in high regard, I didn't mispronounce their name.
Well, two of them are no longer with us, so you're just fine.
You have a good sense of humor. I just watched Gun with my wife, and man, I can understand why it's been nominated and has won Best Picture. It's powerful. And we're going to get to that. I want to talk about that film, if you don't mind. But first, give us a little bit of background so people know where you're coming from and how you got to where you are today.
Well, I went to a little school in Miami called Barry University. And the only reason I even walked into the theater is because the introduction to acting class had kind of a reputation of being easy, as long as you were not shy and you were willing to get on stage. As long as you're willing to do that, you'd probably get an A in the class. And the easy way academically always appealed to me. So, because I wasn't much of a student. And so I went there, and that's where I met these incredible artists, including Alex Dean Alaris, who, you said he wound up winning the Academy Award for Birdman. He wrote Revenant. He wrote the stage play On Your Feet, which is the Gloria Estefan musical. He's currently writing Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, a new take on it. Amazingly talented people I've met down there. It was for a tiny school to produce such artists, you know, people that I see on television all the time. It was incredible. So one part of the class was they made me go to a play, and the play they made me go to was Orphans by Lyle Kessler. It was an incredibly powerful play. It was the first play I'd ever saw that had the F word in it. It was set in Philadelphia. I'm watching it in Miami. Just had an incredible impact on me. And from that point on, I just kind of was hooked, and I just always kind of wanted to pursue it. So from that point, when I graduated from Barry, I moved back to Philadelphia, and that's when I started studying with George DiCenzo, who he was a unique guy. I don't even know how to put it. He was a rough teacher. He was tough. He was almost like a drill sergeant, and he didn't suffer fools gladly, but it was what I needed. You know, a lot of times when you take college classes, it's a lot of, you're the greatest thing since sliced bread, and you're definitely going to make it. And George was the type of guy who said, look, this business is rough, and it's going to chew you up and spit you out if you don't get a thick skin. and I needed it. And George DiCenzo's mentor was this guy, Milton Katsalas, who was based in Los Angeles, but he would teach in New York every summer for about 6 weeks. And I took that class, and that class was really, it was appealing because it had famous people in it. There was Michelle Williams was in the class, who at the time had just done Dawson's Creek, and Jeffrey Tambor was in the class. And it was exciting, and there was a buzz in the room, and it was, you know, it was really cool. And then eventually I wound up at Playhouse West with a guy named Tony Savant, who he's the guy who really encouraged me to get into making movies and writing, and because his philosophy is, and I think it's true, you have to make your own content. If you're going to sit around and wait for a job, you will die. And it's absolutely true. So he said, you got to get out there, and you can't knock on the door of this thing. You got to try and kick it down. And that appealed to me. I thought that's accurate. And that's what got me to where I am right now.
Wow, good. Very good narrative. I can tell you're a writer, and you understand audience. That was great. Thank you. Now, I'm wondering about the power of filmmaking to you. You know, I mean, you're not in it for the money, I'd bet.
Hell,
I mean,
no.
and I look, you know, the theme, at least in Gun, and I'm going to be looking at more of your films now, after being so impressed with Gun, is something that has to do with, you know, an issue that the United States has been struggling with, issues that the United States has been struggling with for years. And, you know, I'm wondering if you see the power of film as a means to connect with your fellow humans, your fellow citizens, or something to that effect.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll tell you the origin of the story. I was talking to my friend Jeff, who at the time he worked at Classic Pistol, which is the gun shop we shot in. Since then, his brother has bought the place, and now they run it. But anyway, we were sitting in this bar, and he was telling me a story about a guy who came into the shop, never shot a gun before, took lessons, bought a gun, went home, and committed suicide. And I said, wow, that's crazy. And kind of as an aside, he says to me, we got the gun back. And I said, what? He said, you know, we got the gun back. I said, what do you mean he got the gun back? And he said, well, you know, the family doesn't want it, and the police don't want it, so we get it back. And I said, well, what do you do with it? And he said, we just clean it off and put it right back up for sale again.
Wow.
Whoa is right. I couldn't believe it. And I said, there's no way in the world that could be true. So I researched it. Not only is it true, there are collectors out there who only collect guns that have been used in suicides, which to me is just, you know, and there's people out there who will say, well, it's only an inanimate object, and it, you know, it's just doing its job or whatever. And I get that, you know, it's just a piece of metal. But that was just so bizarre to me that there's people like that. So that was the basis of how I started it, that, you know, there's people out there like that, that this is, they're into that. And then when I met John, who plays my son in the film.
Yeah, I hated you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. You did a great job.
So, yeah, when I met John, who plays my son in the film, that's when the whole story kind of came together. Because the initial script was it could not have been more cliche. It was three suicides. The gun is kind of the star. And it just follows these people. But when I met John, I thought, you know what, we could go a little deeper with this. We could go a little, you know, something a little bit more that's today, something that affects people. And I think a lot of people, I'm sure nobody, or maybe very few people who are listening have seen the film. But I'll just say this, that, you know, I think there's a perception, especially when you're in the arts community and you live on, you know, the East Coast and a big city like Philadelphia or Los Angeles, I think there's a perception that a lot of, you know, anti-gay feelings, oh, that's all dead anymore. Nobody cares anymore. Well, guess what? There's people that care plenty in this especially in the Midwest. Yeah, a lot of homophobia still alive and well. So, yeah.
And the setting was in Michigan, rural Michigan, I suppose, right?
Yeah, we wanted to make it. Well, the initial thought was to put it in the South. Well, the initial thought was to just put it in Pennsylvania, but Chris Newhard said it accurately. You can't have a kid in Pennsylvania who longs to go to New York because it's only an hour train ride. It's unrealistic. You know, it's not that far. You need to make it further so that it's a trek to get there. And because John's character is based on a guy who when I lived in New York, he was this guy, Mark. He lived in Texas and he grew up in Texas as a gay man, and he was tortured, absolutely tortured. And the only reason he didn't commit he said the only reason I didn't commit suicide, and he meant it, was because he thought there was this oasis out there, and the oasis was called New York City, that there was a city that he could go to where he would never be judged. So that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to create a kid trapped in Michigan thinking about New York because it's the one place where he can breathe. And I just real quick, I was going to say we thought about putting it in the South, but then you have to worry about accents and different things. And the South is tough to recreate when you're in the Northeast. So we settled on Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah. And it works. It's kind of interesting. Over the last couple of months, I've had many guests who have broached this subject. Just 2 weeks ago, I had a professor from one of the SUNY schools, Sean Edgecombe. And, He was talking about how in New York City it's sort of an amazing culture. If you're anything on the fringe there, it's not looked at as odd. You can be yourself, but and he was talking in particular about LGBTQ folk and how there are a lot of rural gay still in this country who have such huge challenges, and that your movie definitely addresses that.
Yeah, well, the thing in New York, what my friend said about New York, it's not even – it's just that nobody cares.
Right.
You know, and you don't – it's a beautiful thing that you can – in New York City, you can walk down a street in like a gorilla suit and nobody blinks an eye. Nobody cares.
Well, Philadelphia is pretty cool too.
Yeah, without question.
My son just graduated from the University of the Arts, and I'd go down there to visit him. And basically, that – campuses in the neighborhood, as they affectionately call the gayborhood. And you walk around and there's such an acceptance and a comfort level that people of all sorts are showing affection to one another, and it's just as it should be, looked at as normal, whereas most parts of the United States that is not going to be the case.
Absolutely not. See, that's we're lulled into this feeling of that it's like this all over the country, and it absolutely is not. I mean, there's people in the South who are still trying to win the Civil War. I mean, this is very – what we have here is an anomaly. It's not what it's really like in most places, I believe.
Well, again, kudos to you for addressing those issues in such a poignant way. And people, you're going to have to check out Gunn to see what I'm talking about. We're talking – with Edward William Wasser, the writer and director here on Troubadours and Rock on Tours, and one of the actors. You'll hate him. now, we can go in so many different directions. I don't know if you want to talk more about what's going on with Gunn, if you want to talk about a new production, or generally speaking, if you'd like to get into some of the challenges of making a film, how you connect and direct actors, cinematographers, everybody involved, editors, sound, costumes, so that everything comes together and emulates what you envision.
Well, right this second, I'll just let you know that August 29th is the ceremony for, they call it Independent Shorts Awards, but it's an award ceremony by IMDb. We're nominated for Best Picture, which was an amazing thrill because there's 30 different categories. From we didn't even get nominated Best LGBT Movie, we got nominated Best Picture, period.
Wow.
And we were the only American nominee. The other nominee is from the UK, and the other nominee is from Germany.
Wow.
So this is very exciting. I mean, I've never been through this where they are I've never been courted to attend to anything. Like, I've been courted for this, and it's just really exciting, and it's really cool. And it's cool that people are getting it, you know, cause I'm a straight guy, and I wrote this script, and I was wondering if people who were gay were going to be into it, if they were going to like it, if they were going to hate it or what. And I was fortunate enough to be accepted by them, and then they all liked it. So it's been quite a thrill.
So that's the reason, I guess, it is resonating mainly. It's about the struggles, the difficulty when someone is not heterosexual and not, you know, falling into normal categories. That's what's compelling people, how you dealt with that subject, those challenges?
Well, I attended a I exchanged emails with a guy who he had a festival in Chicago. The name escapes me right now, but it was a really famous gay and lesbian film festival. We exchanged emails for, I don't know, a month and a half or so. And I get to the festival in Chicago, and I see him. He's wearing a name tag, so I know who he is. And I went over and I introduced myself, and 30 seconds into speaking, he says to me, "You're straight?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Oh my God, I had no idea. I could have swore you were gay." I was like, "No." No. So yeah, to tackle that subject and be accepted by them was, you know, like I said, it's quite a thrill. I mean, that nobody has scoffed yet. And in fact, quite the opposite. You know, I've been welcomed into that community. So it's been pretty cool.
Well, if you did it the wrong way, you wouldn't have been, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
right, yeah.
You must have addressed the issues in a way that those folks who are indeed experiencing those issues felt was fair and sensitive and thoughtful and so yeah, good work. Now, I mean, it's a human issue. That's why you're just being a good human.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the thing with the character who plays my son. Everybody can relate to being somewhere where they don't want to be. Everybody can relate to being the outsider, especially if you're an artist. You know, most artists, including myself, but I have to work a day job, and I walk in there every morning and I think, I don't belong here. These are not my people. And then I go to acting class or I go to a film festival and say, these are my people. You know, and I'm not saying anything against people who are, you know, who are not artistic or whatever. It's not about that. It's just we don't connect, you know. So I think everybody can relate to John's character on that level, where you just are somewhere, you don't belong there, and you can't get out. It's a horrible feeling. So I think that's what people relate to. And then the politician character, I think people can relate to, you know, not a lot of artists are like this. They are not able to express who they really are for some unknown reason. You know, a lot of parents, when they say, if you're a kid, you tell your parent, "Hey, look, I think I might be gay," or whatever, they're going to freak out sometimes. So the politician is about stifling who you really are and living inside that bubble and yearning to get out. And then when it does get out, sometimes it backfires on you.
Well, speaking of politicians having to stifle who you really are, I mean, that's another subject area that we can get into as citizens of these United States. So that's part of the reason we don't have good politicians. You know?
You are exactly right, because they don't want everybody into their business.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
Right. And those who might, in essence, be good people, they once they decide they're going to be successful politicians in the way it works now, the system, they have to give up a lot of maybe what they would do otherwise just to make sure they get enough support by the mainstream so that they can keep their position. It's terrible.
Yeah, and you're asking your family to do the same thing, and they didn't sign up for this. you know, and your children, they're going to go through what your children are up to. And then they, like I said, they didn't sign up for that. So most people are saying, you know what, I'm going in another direction.
Right. Right. Yeah. Pete Buttigieg, he's always, he's never tried to hide it. I guess he did. He did try to hide it for a while.
He was in the military.
Yeah, that's right. When he was in the military, he had to hide it. But you know, it has changed a lot, you know, but still a lot more to be done in that area. And so many areas here right now, I presume you're not happy with, generally speaking, the way our country is going at the federal level. Maybe I'm wrong. And if so, I apologize for being presumptuous, but,
I think anybody who is happy right now, regardless of where you stand, that would be shocking to me. Even if you're, like I said, you're the staunchest Republican, if you could turn on the news and be happy, wow. Okay, good for you, I guess.
Yeah, and the arts, you know, that where I was going with that is, I think all too often, what the things that you're exploring through your art, through film, through a movie like Gun, are the real issues that, and you know, human depths that we all struggle with. As you said a little while ago, most everybody can relate to not feeling like they fit in and trying to figure out who they are. And we try to like smooth over all that all too often when we get on a grander scale, and you know, at the federal level, you know, in Washington, in Congress. And how are we ever going to really address who we are as people, especially in this diverse society that is, you know, so wonderfully alive here in the United States of America, if we try to suppress and smooth over?
No, well, because the politicians are people, as a generality, these are people that have never had a situation where they didn't fit in, because they are always around their own kind. They're always in a country club. They're always at Harvard. They're always in some private skull and bones type thing where everybody looks alike. Everybody dresses alike. Everybody wears the wingtip shoes, and they're never in an uncomfortable situation ever. I mean, these are people whose hands have never done one hard bit of work in their lives. So, and then they become politicians, and then they can't relate to somebody who can't pay rent. They can't relate to certain struggles and whatever. Their idea of not fitting in is when their car breaks down and they're forced to eat McDonald's. They're not really most politicians. It's changing. I'll give them that. It's changing. But for the most part, the politicians are the Kennedys and those types of families that are zillionaires. Can't relate to the common guy.
No. And how are you, as an artist, are you trying to, through your art, affect change? Are you just trying to, you know, get through and express yourself, you know, in the way that you know, the way that you feel?
Well, this movie was not intended to really be a political thing. It was, when I started writing it, it seemed pretty clear that Hillary Clinton was going to be president. So we started filming in 2017 when Trump had just kind of started. But it wasn't meant to be a political thing. But I guess, man, it was the right message at the right time, because when I started putting it on the film festivals, people were gobbling it up left and right, and it was just, you know, I'm just a guy trying to make it as an actor and an artist, because I have something to say. But like I said, I just lucked out. I just lucked out that what was going on politically was going on when the movie came out. If this movie came out when Obama was president, maybe people would have been like, that was pretty good, you know. But the fact that it came out when it did, that's what I think I kind of lucked out with.
And what about guns? I mean, are you mentioned that you're a gun user, right?
I'm not a gun owner. I have shot and I've enjoyed it. And my friends are gun enthusiasts. I am not anti-gun. I'm anti, you know, these crazy people having guns. But the logical next question is, how do you stop it? And the answer is, I don't know. I don't know. It's a tough issue. It's a very, very difficult issue. And if I'm running for Congress, I'll swear I have an answer. But I think the country right now is so polarized. There needs to be some basic common sense rule that says if you have a rap sheet longer than Al Capone's, if you've been in and out of psychiatric facilities for years and years and years, maybe you shouldn't be allowed to get a gun. But of course, you bring that up to the one side, they freak out. And then the other side freaks out, and it just seems like compromise has been thrown out the window. So, but yeah, I'm like I said, I'm not an anti-gun. I certainly never protested. I have shot. My grandfather was a hunter and that type of thing. So it would be hypocritical for me to say I'm anti-gun because I have embraced it in the past.
What about folks that on that one issue, they make their decisions, on any one issue, to support or not support a particular group or politician. What do you think of that? I mean,
first of all, if you're all one way or you're all the other way, you're just stupid. If you're wildly conservative on every single issue, then you're an idiot. If you're wildly liberal on every single issue, then you're an idiot. Like Chris Rock put it best. He said, on taxes and finances, I'm conservative. He said, prostitution and gay marriage, I'm liberal. That's the way everybody should be. There should be, things that you're liberal about and things you're conservative about. Violent crime, I'm conservative about violent crime. Gay issues, obviously, I'm pretty liberal about. The arts, I'm obviously pretty liberal about. So you should be one way or the other, but that doesn't exist anymore. You have two television networks currently devoted, one to the super left, one to the super right. And you have nobody who says, hey, why don't we just get in the middle? But that would be boring and nobody would watch it. So,
yeah, it's not about facts. It's not about analysis. It's about attention.
It's about and raising people's blood pressure.
Right. Exactly. Now, what projects are you working on? I mentioned earlier that you have something in post-production. Was that accurate?
Yeah, but that was it's a short comedy that I did. Should be. I'm just going to release that one on online. Just kind of probably partner up with one of the comedy pages on social media, and then pay to advertise a little bit. I'm not saying I'm not proud of it, but the message is kind of silly. But the next one I want to do is called Leopards, and that one is about how it's about alcoholism, and it's I'm coming at it from a stance that sometimes alcoholism wins. You watch different. I'm sick of watching unrealistic TV shows and movies where they portray alcoholism and drug use, and the end is always, he walks in the rehab and the implication is he kicked it. Well, guess what? 80-something 5% of the time, you go right back to it. So it's unrealistic. So this is going to be a movie where it explores alcoholism and alcoholism wins.
Is it going to be a short or full length?
No, it's going to be a short. Right this minute, well, I certainly don't have the funds for it. I definitely want to get into the full length business, but it's a rough business to get into because you're asking people to work for free and then they have their own schedules and I have my own schedules and Chris Newhart, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, he has his own schedule. He does this for a living, whether it be corporate videos or whether it be short films for other people or whether it be commercials, you name it, he does this for a living. And he jumps on an airplane the way you and I jump into a car. He was in San Francisco for 3 days, and then he comes back, and then he's going to Sydney, Australia. It's crazy. So you to do a full length, you need to pin all those people down for a good 6 to 8 weeks.
And Chris was your cinematographer?
Yes, and he's a very, very dear friend of mine. And he was the DP on this, and he's amazingly talented. But yeah, so to do a full length, you've got to pin all these people down for a good 6 weeks and get people to work for free, and not to mention the expense and whatever. It's difficult. But what I should do, and I will do, is I would like to expand the script for Gunn to make it a full length. What I'm, you know, obviously it would be great if somebody says, hey, I like your story. Is it for sale? I said, as a matter of fact, it is. So that would be nice. But yeah, I would like to get into the full length business, but right now I'm stuck in the world of shorts.
Well, again, Gunn was amazingly powerful. I wish you the best at the IMDb Film Awards. Again, nominated for Best Picture, Edward William Wasser, writer and director. And it's great having you. Go ahead.
Yeah, just so people know, we're actually going to release Gunn online September 1st, which is a Sunday, because it's been in the film festival world for a long time, and we were going to release it earlier, but when this award came out, the big thing is with film festivals is you cannot have something available for free that they want to charge money to get people to come in and see, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. So once this is over, September 1st, which is a Sunday, that morning we're going to release it online. So anybody who would like to see it, just put in Edward William Wasser in the search in YouTube, and you can check it out for yourself. Or you could come to the awards, Independent Shorts Award, Raleigh Studios in Hollywood, California.
Yeah, I'll be out there. I'll see you. We'll have a drink.
Yeah, okay.
Edward William Wasser's the name. Type it in. You'll be able to find his work. And it was great talking with you on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. Thanks for taking the time out.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Have a good one.
All right, you too.
An excerpt from The Awful Fate of the Sex Goddess by Parker Tyler, originally published in 1968. What by virtue of the movies, is a sex goddess. It is easy to point, say, to Sophia Loren, imagine her quite naked, as may be done without the camera's assistance, and have the right answer. But Miss Loren's case is relatively simple and unaffected. The matter, with regard to the movie's history of sex, is too complex for mere pointing. The sex goddess's mutation, starting with the celebrated vampire, is something to arrest and fascinate movie buffs and other susceptible scholars. Its ups and downs, turnabouts and triumphs, take on cosmic dimensions. Going in as straight a line as possible from Theda Barrow to Greta Garbo, one's wits are staggered by so vast a change visible in one stroke of the imagination. And that stroke takes us only to 1941. Technically, Garbo is a direct descendant of her distant Hollywood predecessor, the fatal queen of love and ruler of man, which a sex goddess is, or was, supposed to be. I change the tense, and there's the rub. For whatever reasons, a sharp decline of divine dimensions in nominal sex goddesses has come about. It is as if sex and goddess were terms that, idiomatically, no longer agreed. Take the case of one who bore a notable physical resemblance to Sophia Loren, Jane Russell, a goddess ephemeral and now long extinct. Miss Russell was two great breasts mounted upon a human pedestal with a doll's head to top it off. Besides being no actress at all, which Loren, after all, is, Russell was hardly a sound recipe for a sex goddess. Her peculiar weakness may have lain in the very fact that a California judge, passing on the claim that her film, The Outlaw, was obscene, owing largely to her salient and partly exposed mammary equipment, decided that any God-given, such as breasts, could not be obscene. Goddesses, by definition, are beyond the law, but voluptuous breasts are but the window dressing of sex divinity. Jane represented one of the last historic efforts to invent a great personality on the basis of sex appeal alone. Plausibly, the physical dimensions of sex goddesses first tended to be ample. Theda Barrow had a maternal figure. She was, in fact, remarkably like a suburban housewife circa World War I, bitten by the glamour bug into imagining herself supreme seductress of men, and by some weird turn of fate, succeeding at it. Today, an Elizabeth Taylor who succeeds through her proportions and personality start by being those of the reigning office minx, from whom neither president of the company nor errand boy is safe. But another weird turn of fate, by another weird turn of fate, we get instead, in this actress, a universal Miss Sexpot. For a sex goddess, one is obliged to call that a come-down. Nowadays, sex goddessing is more a trade than something, as it were, acquired by divine privilege. Another Italian star, Gina Lollobrigida, oddly resembles Miss Taylor, although she is better looking. Lollobrigida is simply Sophia Loren, seen a few paces further off, a sort of reproduction in minor scale. But big and beautiful as La La Ren is, we must face the fact that sheer majesty in the female body has become, historically, badly compromised as a glamour asset. Being a sex goddess has nothing whatsoever to do with the sexual act as such. Getting laid is a strictly human, quite unglamorous occupation. Mediating between Barrow and Garbo, Mae West turned up as an eccentric, utterly unexpected manifestation of sex divinity. Like the old gods of the Greek plays, she appeared with the primal authority of, "Here I am." Part of the majesty of Mae's corseted figure, hefty of hip and bosom, was its anachronism. She duplicated the physical image of the late 19th century stage, where even chorus girls were girthy. The very pathos of distance helped make West a goddess, and historic. I confess to having been, in 1944, the first to describe what her style owed to the female impersonator. Just about everything basic. A true parody of sex divinity, May was the opposite of the classic vampire because she aimed at both being funny and good-natured, qualities more plebeian than royal or divine. I, for one, think it an awful fate that the grand profession of sex goddessing should have sunk to the petty profession of sex shoddessing. The robotizing trend of female charms, against which only the cartoon pair of Playboy, FTC, seems holding out, must not be underrated. Think, ladies and gentlemen, the supreme goal of male propulsion, as foreseen in 2001, A Space Odyssey, is a geometric black slab with unproved sexual capacities. Theta Bearer would, tacitly, be more negotiable than that, and shapelier. Come to think of it, Marilyn Monroe came along in those fidgety 50s and altered the whole setup. There was something genuine about her, and really pathetic, as if she were all too human to exercise the great craft of queening it for the tradition. We know what finally happened to her. Maybe she was the last goddess actually seeming to be made out of flesh rather than foam rubber. Something to sleep with, not on. And that was probably her fatal mistake. Goddesses are to be slept about.
When the little bluebird, who has never said a word, starts to sing, spring, spring. When the little bluebell in the bottom of the dell starts to ring, ding, ding. When the little blue clerk in the middle of his work starts a tune to the moon up above. It is nature, that's all, simply telling us to fall in love. And that's why birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. In Spain, the best upper sets do it. Lithuanians, and let's do it, let's do it, let's fall in love. The Dutch in old Amsterdam do it, not to mention the Finns. Folks in Siam do it, think of Siamese twins. Some Argentines without means do it. People say in Boston even beans do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Romantic sponges, they say, do it. Oysters down in Oyster Bay do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Cold Cape Cod clams, gainst their wish, do it. Even lazy jellyfish do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Electric eels, I might add, do it. Though it shocks them, I know. Why ask if shad do it? Way to bring me shad row in shallow shoals. English souls do it. Goldfish in the privacy of bowls do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love.
Bird. How does the caged bird sing? Poet Angelou knew. One sings because they must. Through the outside world's misplaced trust and misunderstood lust,
as it sleeps in the underbrush, the dank brown leaves of cynicism and empty thrusts into the dust. The caged bird sings on a road trip to nirvana or bust.
Guitar of Mike, please. Guitar Mike. Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. A long way from my home, yeah, yeah, love. Singing freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone. Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone. Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone. Yeah, long, long, long way, way from my home.
And there you have it, episode 332 of Troubadours and Rock On Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. And I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Edward William Wasser. I also like to thank our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese. And these musical artists, Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, The Rolling Stones, St. Paul and the Broken Bones, David Gray, Cole Porter, Richie Havens, and of course Brentford Marsalis and Terrence Blanchard too. Thank you so much for listening. Until next week, let's give it a go and try to enjoy this one.